Ria from Yes! Exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point. And we started out with Ilhan Irsane giving us Invite Your Eye from the Invite Your Eye CD. It's just the top of the hour now, so now it's time for Living Writers.
Good afternoon. If you're just tuning in, I'm so glad you did. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so happy to have Katie Hartsock here in the studio with me, and also poet James Matthew Wilson joining us via phone from... James, are you in Grand Rapids?
I am, yep.
Oh, excellent. So James Matthew Wilson joining us via phone from Grand Rapids. And coming up in half an hour, we'll have the poet J.C. Charles also joining us via phone. Today, we are all here in the studio present or virtually to celebrate an event that's coming to campus tomorrow. Katie, would you mind telling us a little bit about what this event is? And and a shout out to Scott Lyons, too.
Definitely. Yes. So we are really excited to host a poetry reading that is being put on by the Kateri Institute for Catholic Studies, which is a newer group at UM aiming to bring together Catholic faculty, staff, students. For several years now, there have been a nice schedule of lineups with lectures and readings. And tomorrow, I will be reading. I'm so honored and excited to be reading with James and Jane, James Matthew Wilson and J.C. Charles. We will be at the Michigan League Ballroom starting at 6 o'clock. That is, again, in the Michigan League. I think it's on the second floor. And there will be refreshments. There will be books to buy, and we would be happy to sign them, of course. And it should be a lovely evening with poetry and praise and thinking about the relationship between poetry and faith in our work and our world.
And it also sounds like a wonderful sense of community that will be happening in the place itself.
Yes. Yeah. And we're excited to have the Kateri community come. But then also we would, love to see people from all over the Ann Arbor who would like to come. It's open to the public. Feel free to come and drop by.
Oh, wonderful. Well, thanks. Thanks, Katie, for talking us through this wonderful news of this event tomorrow. And James, thanks for joining us. Now you're here via phone. I've got your book on the table with us, St. Thomas and the Forbidden Birds. I also have Katie Hartsock's book, Wolf Trees, on the table. Right now, before we start the conversation, I'm going to read the bio out of each book. So just to put everyone in the picture with the folks we have here in studio. And to be fair, I'm going to do it alphabetically. So first, Katie Hartsock is the author of two poetry collections, Wolf Trees 2023 and Bed of Impatience 2016, both from Able Muse Press. Her poems appear widely in journals such as Ecotone Poetry, Kenyon Review, 32 Poems, The Three Penny Review, Birmingham Poetry Review, among other places. She is an associate professor of English and creative writing at Oakland University in Michigan. She lives in Ann Arbor with her husband and their young sons. Welcome, Katie.
Thanks so much, T.
And poet. We have another poet, James Matthew Wilson, is the Cullen Foundation Chair in English Literature and the founding director of the MFA in Creative Writing Program at the University of St. Thomas. The author of 13 previous books, his collection of poems, The Strangeness of the Good, 2020, won the Catholic Media Awards Prize for Poetry. The Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture awarded him the Hyatt Prize in 2017. Memoria College gave him the Parnassus Prize in 2022, and the Conference on Christianity and Literature twice gave him the Lionel Basney Award. He serves as poet in resident of the Benedict XVI Institute, editor of Colosseum Books, and poetry editor of Modern Age magazine. He lives with his wife and five children in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Welcome, James. It's so lovely to have also Michigan poets, people who choose Michigan to live and work in and build community in.
Well, I had to choose Michigan after great difficulty because I spent 12 years living in the Philadelphia suburbs, spending the whole time trying to get back to Michigan. So I still feel like I'm just returned home from exile.
Really? Really? So, well, welcome back then. Welcome, James. Welcome. And does this, was there something about like a return to Michigan where you feel like a special connection to the place that also perhaps connects to how you see yourself in the world as a poet, as a poet who identifies as Catholic as well?
There is, yeah. I published an article last year in First Things magazine called Sweet Land of Michigan, and it was just about the the everlasting travails of my, the first part of my career of trying to get back home and finally being able to do it. And I think a lot of the reflection I've been led to do anyhow is just on the idea of piety, that being pious, being fiercely attached and devoted to things, particular things, is how we become rooted in the world. And even though the Catholic Church is the universal church and is in that sense placeless or beyond place, there's nothing about religious belief that doesn't also necessitate our knowing that we have to have a local habitation to ground ourselves in and to construct a life out of or within.
Yes, and I love that. Thanks for saying that, James, because I also noticed on the covers of each of your books, and so perhaps this was something that you each had a hand in being able to design, like the image on the books. The natural world is present. For example, your book, St. Thomas and the Forbidden Birds, has a beautiful picture that it features an owl and many other birds, as well as flowers and stars and branches. Katie Hartsock's Wolf Trees features a wolf tree as well as a plane. And then Jane's book, Ponds, again gives us an image of water, trees, a partial moon. And so it feels like the rootedness that you're talking about is present in all three of these images. Was that important to Katie? What was it? What do you think about responding to James's comment? And
I love the flavor and the faith of James' comment so much, because while I'm not originally from Michigan, I'm originally from Youngstown, Ohio. I feel very at home in the Midwest, and having done my MFA at Michigan, I also returned to Ann Arbor after time spent in Chicago, which I was always, where am I going next? How can I get somewhere more towards Michigan, Ohio? And I think that time spent meditating in Midwest woods, whether it's in my hometown or here in Ann Arbor, or any, the beautiful parks in Michigan, that has been a way that, like, walking and connecting to the land has just been part of, like, poetry and prayer for me. And so I think that it's the local is what surrounds us. And, you know, what surrounds us also leads us beyond. And I think it's a nice way to think about being grounded, but also ethereal or something at the same time.
How are poems like prayers?
I mean, one of my favorite comments by a poetry critic, Robert von Hallberg, is that there's something implicitly faithful about writing a poem because, like, it's a step towards believing that words have meaning. And I think that step between that words have meaning is then a natural road down to, like, well, then, and what does that meaning point towards? Is it the divine? Is it something bigger than ourselves? And so I think that anytime anyone writes a poem, there's actually something of a prayer in it, because they're talking to themselves through language or that moment or that occasion. And but James, I'd love to hear what you have to say about the relationship between poetry and prayer too.
The problem with that question, I've spent so much time thinking about it, I still don't have a good answer, but I can say this much, that when I got interested in poetry, and I was sitting in a literature seminar at University of Michigan when this happened, the first thing that caught my attention about poetry was meter, was the weighing of syllables and the placing them into a line to make a verse, to make a line of iambic pentameter. And I think what I detected there was, you know, what Wallace Stevens calls that rage to order, the desire to bring in the use of language to figure forth a sense of the orderliness of things. And I mean, one of the crucial dimensions of prayer, especially liturgical prayer, is that it's language formalized. You know, Catholics don't make up their own prayers. We we receive them and we recite them and we memorize them. And sometimes we recite them in decades at a time. And I think that's expressive of, you know, one of the great insights that human beings have had, you know, at least since Plato or the ancient Egyptians, that that there's a kind of number, there's a kind of numeracy that's present at the heart of things that's indicative that they are ordered, and that they're ordered because they have meaning. And so, you know, one of the joys of writing a poem, especially when it's on, say, gross or evil or ugly or tragic subject matter, is that you can weigh in tension the orderliness of language alongside the catastrophes of history. And then in a poem that rises up towards prayer, that rises up towards praise, you see those moments where the ironies and the tensions of the world begin to fade away. And the sort of orderly temporal expression of language begins to sort of speak of something beyond time and an order beyond, you know, all finitude. And I think that's definitely the sort of trajectory I've traced in some of my poems, is kind of working through catastrophe in order to try to find a way to make a single statement of just pure praise.
Thank you, James. Thank you. With the praise, with finding praise connected in with the poems and the natural world for both of you in some ways, I'm trying to think of Mary Oliver, the poet Mary Oliver comes to mind, who also finds ways to praise and with the natural world. Both of you, Katie and James, you also call in more historic, more of the story particular to a, like an ordered or organized mm-hmm. faith, like mm-hmm. the Catholic Church. There are these moments that come through or are named. Mm-hmm. How do you see that working in your poems? This is a question for both of you.
I guess I'll start by saying that I was interested in poetry for a long time before I really learned about prosody and meter. You know, I had taken many poetry workshops and classes, and it wasn't until my later 20s that I started actually learning about meter and pentameter and you know, fitting the line. And it happened to coincide, and maybe not, with my return to the church. And it's such an interesting connection, because as I was thinking more about this to me, and it feels almost embarrassing to say, but this kind of mind-blowing revelation of like what I could do with iambic pentameter when I went back to some favorite old poets, seeing what they did with pentameter and seeing it for the first time, or, you know, or tetrameter, or, you know, whatever it is, and to see the order of that, but also the substitutions and the freedom and the flexibility that I think, you know, the order of meter is always kind of moving at the edges with those possibilities for substitutions. But I would say for me, it was an interesting coincidence that at the time I was learning about meter and starting to write in it myself, I was also learning that I wanted to go back to the church, and that I had started to read St. Augustine's Confessions in a graduate class at Northwestern in my doctorate program. And something about reading the Latin, which that's a work in prose, but Augustine was very aware of the cadences of Latin rhythm, even in his prose. And he was a poet, interestingly. Like, he won some poetry contests when he was young, and he kind of like half brags about it in the Confessions, like, oh yeah, I won, but no big deal. But yeah, so I think that a direction and an orientation in both my poetry and in my faith, and what I wanted, how I wanted to direct myself, it happened at the same time, and I'm really grateful for it. So
I could say practically the same thing. I took an interest. I came to meter, it sounds like, a little bit earlier than Katie did, but it was at a time when I was studying at Michigan that I was really rediscovering the tradition, and the traditions, but also kind of the tradition, the sense that, that a culture is not a self-made thing, that it's a work of many hands, and it's usually participants in a culture are standing on the shoulders of giants. And the way in which I came to discover that, or it's probably a way a lot of University of Michigan students came to discover it. First of all, I had classes with Ralph Williams, and the way he could talk about the brilliant features of the literary tradition, and also I took his class on the Bible and scripture, were just amazing. But also Allison Cornish, who I think no longer teaches at Michigan, but had just started teaching there when I was a sophomore. I just at random, actually, that's not the way to put it. It felt like the hand of fate pushed me to enroll for no coherent reason, no rational conscious reason, in her class on Dante's Divine Comedy.
Mm, yeah.
And reading that poem, I was a kid who was raised Catholic and went to Catholic school, went to St. Thomas Aquinas school, and grew up, you know, thinking I knew something. As I read through Dante's poem for the first time, I thought, who's been lying to me? Who has been hiding all of this stuff from me? And Dante was my way into, not just into, you know, into scholastic theology, but also into the classics, into the you know, and I mean classical mythology, into Virgil and Homer and so many things else. And so I just had this sense that there's a tradition and there's an order to things that I, in my sort of callow 19-year-old mind, have not even begun to envision, much less to plumb. And I just wanted to be part of it. I wanted to swim in it. And so I did. And one of the ways in which I did that was learning how to write verse and to feel that I was connecting in some meaningful way with the poets of ages past by learning how to use their medium and try to write in a fresh and contemporary way, but in a way that they would still recognize as part of the art of poetry.
Ah, thanks, James. That is lovely. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, James, will you read a poem for us?
Sure, that'd be great.
Today on Living Writers, Katie Hartsock is here in the studio, her book of poems, Wolf Trees. We have James Matthew Wilson joining us via phone, his latest book, St. Thomas and the Forbidden Birds. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Jason behind the glass, and we'll be back. Welcome back. You've got Loving Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so happy to have in studio Katie Hartsock, poet Katie Hartsock here, and poet James Matthew Wilson joining us via phone. We were just having a lovely, it feels like there's a lot to say, and the time is moving quickly. So I want to just ask, James, would you mind reading a poem? I know. Would you like to read one from your earlier book? Like, what? Read what you want. You know, whatever you'd like. We'd love to hear.
I was. If we had more time, I'd read the poem of walking through the autumnal streets of Ann Arbor on Sunday morning, going to Mass, which was always a lonely kind of pilgrimage. But I think I'll read that tomorrow night when I come to Ann Arbor, so that people who are in the audience can hear it. But
James, are you doing a teaser now for tomorrow's event? Yeah. Very nicely done.
Yeah. You come, you'll hear it.
Very nice, so, very nice.
And I'll give you a free toaster. But I'll just read the title poem from the new book, St. Thomas and the Forbidden Birds, which, since you already talked about the beautiful cover, which I agree is amazing, and I thank some author of a bestiary from, you know, sometime in the Middle Ages in England for that wonderful owl on the cover. This is a poem about St. Thomas Aquinas writing the Summa Theologica, and when he wrote, he dictated, and he dictated to three different amanuenses simultaneously, each of them writing down a different work. He was usually writing three books at a time. It's like the guy who plays chess on multiple times, or multiple games at the same time. And this is about when he's going through the Mosaic Law of why the Mosaic Law forbid the eating of different kinds of birds. And we get this beautiful, this is all in the Summa Theologica. I didn't make this part up. I just copied it and put it in rhyme because I just thought he was so clever. But Aquinas is giving us a kind of bestiary, a kind of account of what the birds symbolize in the world. So with that, I'll just read the poem. St. Thomas and the Forbidden Birds. Beyond the window, morning sparrows made their song as if the whole world's goodness paid its plenty out for them and them alone. The old saint heard their joy and squelched a moan as his legs, stiff and heavy still with sleep, arranged themselves beneath his cassocked heap of belly. Where had he left off before? He asked his three amanuenses, more for their sake, sprightly fingers, sluggish minds, than his. One said, with the forbidden kinds of birds, and what their figures signified for Moses, who charged the eagle's flight with pride. Aquinas sat a moment, mind withdrawn from his mouth's taste of buttered loaves, the dawn without, the wish for more wood in the fire to clear the frost from stone, or to admire the cool, swift brilliance of all he said, as a swan plumed his white and well-turned head. He spoke, the long-beaked ibis feeds on snakes to represent the man whom nothing slakes. Feasting upon dead bodies' open gore, the vulture stands for all who thrive through war. When Noah let the raven out to fly, it never did return to signify such men whose souls are blackened by foul lust, or who, unkind, won't pay back trust with trust. The plodding puffball ostrich is that which figures all those weighed down with growing rich. And hearing God's call plants their soiled head. Plovers, like gossips, on stray words are fed. And who, on seeing the gull, does not admire that its bright wings to heaven may aspire, and yet it wastes its hours adrift at sea, gorging on fishy sensuality. The hoopoe builds its nest on heaps of dung, just as despair's eyes view the world all wrong. He paused then at the thought of earthly sorrows, our sickly past, incarnadine tomorrows, the myriad things that whistle arcane truth to please old minds and to instruct raw youth, and bore down on his broken knees to pray for such a world that had so much to say.
Thanks, James.
Love those last lines. And I also love the plovers feeding on stray words. Plovers are so awesome.
Yeah. So, James, for this one, what's it like to read this one aloud knowing that you're like part of the work of the poem is also the rhyme, the movement, the order that you talked about earlier.
That's just so much of what poetry manifests to me, I suppose, it's the appearance of order, and that the intellectual delight that comes with coming up with rhymes is so akin to all those other movements of the mind that can perceive truth, that can perceive what is beautiful, and can move through those things to sort of, towards wisdom, towards an understanding of the whole of things. And it was such a, writing this poem, the when I sat down to do it, all I originally was going to do was take Thomas Aquinas's account of the birds and just make couplets of them. I wasn't even intending to write a poem. But then as I wrote those couplets in the middle of the poem, I could see him hunkered down in his cell with the amanuenses. And it was so vivid. I thought, okay, this is going to be a complete poem. And I'm going to dedicate this whole book to Thomas Aquinas. So, I'm glad you guys like the end of it. Cause just that one of the themes of the book is simultaneously the goodness of the world and the intelligibility of the world, but also, the terror of the world, mm-hmm. And the presence of evil. And that if you want to see goodness in the world, you're going to have to see it through evil, not just ignore what's the catastrophes around us.
Yes. Yes. And so I love that it happens to be the poem that is the title poem for the book, and that you take us to this moment where you knew that this was going to be the book itself when you were making in the act of creating this poem, and that you found it also by entering in, trusting the words, these couplets, but then the images that came to you that you saw, because that's what I feel like as soon as you began reading this poem, the narrative qualities of it were so, so vivid immediately.
Yes.
And believable.
That's, I started at Michigan as a fiction writer, and I studied with Nicholas Del Bunco and Charles Baxter, and, but it was, these people are all retired now, but
their presences are still here.
Yes.
Go ahead, James.
I was just gonna say it was Larry Goldstein who got me hooked on Lawrence Goldstein who got me hooked on meter, and I just thought, and it took a few years for me to say, all right, that's it, I'm not gonna write novels, I'm not gonna write short stories, I'm gonna write poems. But but it took me a while to figure out how to write a good lyric poem, because lyric poems, the intellectual movement is just so different from a short story, at least at its best. So now it's been kind of one of the pleasures of, as I've sort of fallen more naturally into the lyric mode, to be able to get a little narrative and storytelling back into my poetry.
Mm-hmm. You might want to know, James, that T and I both studied with Larry in our time in the MFA program. So,
awesome.
Shout out.
to
the spirit of Larry. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And James, thank you so much for joining us today, because this time has flown by. I feel like now we should mention again the event tomorrow.
Oh, sure. So if you want to hear James read the poem he teased he would tomorrow evening on campus, come to the Michigan League Ballroom. That's on the second floor of the Michigan League on University Avenue. And we'll be starting at 6 p.m. There'll be three poets, myself, James, and Jane Charle, and free and open to the public, books and refreshments after the reading and discussion.
James, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I'll see you tomorrow, and enjoy conversing with Jane.
Oh, we will. You're still here with us. today on Living Writers, James Matthew Wilson, his book Saint Thomas and the Forbidden Birds. I'm T. Hetzel. We have Katie Hartsock in the studio and Jason behind the glass. We'll be back. Thank you. Welcome back. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel. And today we have got poems and poets and poems for you folks. So glad you're here. And hello, Jane. Are you there on the line, Jane?
I sure am.
Hi.
Yay.
We've got poet J.C. Charle joining us here via phone. And Jane, you're speaking to us from Detroit?
Yeah. Yep, just a little bit up the road.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Okay, so glad you're here. And we're going to jump right in now to... And James says hi. Also, Jane, James says hello.
Hi.
I'll read your short bio on the back of your latest book, Ponds, and out with Cascade Books this year. And then we'll jump into the conversation. J.C. Charle is an American poet, playwright, and critic. Her poetry has appeared in many American and European outlets, including the BBC, the Hopkins Review, the New Ohio Review, the American Journal of Poetry, the Lamp, Measure Review, and others. She's the author of a verse drama, Sonnet le Matinées. She lives in Detroit with her husband and children. We're just up the road. So, Jane, welcome. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Katie and James, we're talking about what it means to them. And it's, I know it's a hard question to throw at you here, but the working in the world as a poet, how do you use poems and what is the meaning in that for you as a poet that identifies as a Catholic, as a Catholic poet?
That's a really good question. I think that's a question that at least I spend a lot of time thinking about, and I suspect Katie and James do too. I've always kind of said to my husband, someday I hope that I don't write poetry anymore, because ideally I will have learned to pray really effectively. Because the impulses are kind of the same for me. And so the better I get at praying, the less urgent the poetic impulse becomes generally. And I'm not particularly good at praying right now. I think when I say that, what I mean is that even though poetry is, it's less generally analytical and didactic than prose, but it's still an attempt to use language to reach things that are outside of language. And I guess I always kind of hope that someday I will learn to pray in a way that I don't even need to use the language, and I can just be with God, who is that which is outside of language, instead of having to have that interposing barrier of language, even poetic language. That's my vision of it. And I know that that's not going to be a universal impulse, but that's kind of how I've thought about it ever since I got really serious about poetry.
Well, it's funny that you should say that, Jane, because the things that you're saying are the things that Katie and James were also saying in the first half of the program.
Yeah, so much so that through language we're reaching towards something, whether it's, a more inarticulable divinity, divine world, or a kind of order, or a sense of like where those edges of order and the ether blur. I think that language is, it can feel like a wall or it can feel like a window. And I feel like that in those moments of prayer, that dichotomy also exists. Is there something that I can reach through here, or am I feeling a separation? And that's what brought me to this poem or to this prayer.
And Jane, I feel like many of your poems in Ponds is like they are interested in the beyond, like that's being named, or what the endeavor to find.
Yeah, that's definitely one of my obsessions.
So, hey, this is now here is like a very moving from the very abstract and the most difficult, a very specific question for you about your latest book out this year, Ponds. So ponds and pond, the word pond, it's woven throughout. What was your reason for this? Like, how did this become the title poem, and how is it working throughout this collection?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I kind of started writing this collection back in college when I learned about Theodoric the Ostrogoth and about Cassiodorus, who was a late antiquity, right at the very beginning of the Middle Ages. He was a scholar who kind of compiled the original liberal arts curriculum. So it's a fascinating historical character. But one of his hobbies was, I mean, it was, he took it so seriously, he wouldn't even call it a hobby. He would build fish ponds, and he would keep all kinds of exotic fish in them. He lived in Ravenna, Italy, and he would just cultivate these gorgeous ponds. And that work of making the ponds alongside writing curricula for the liberal arts and doing scriptural commentary and even advising the king, the emperor, on political decisions, that he would always come back to the ponds. And I just found that so interesting. So that symbol has stuck with me for, I mean, well over a decade now. And then I actually wrote a lot of this collection while I lived next to a pond. I lived on a farm with my son and daughter and husband. We just lived in a trailer next to a pond, and I really loved watching the pond change over seasons and seeing how it was its own little world. So then when I wrote the poem Ponds, which is in the voice of Theodoric the Ostrogoth, I loved it, and it seemed like it kind of brought together a lot of the themes from my other poems. So that's kind of how it all came about.
It's so wonderful to hear that this book has been in the making for 10 years.
Yeah.
What's one of the earliest, can you remember one of the earliest poems that still is part of this?
Yeah, sure. So there's a poem in here called Philosopher's Millstone. And I wrote that back in 2011, I think. I wrote that in college. And then kind of a lot of these I wrote in graduate school. So between 2015 and 2019, and then only a few of them have I written. Oh, that's not true. Maybe a third of them I wrote after graduate school. But the oldest one is Philosopher's Millstone.
Oh, and what is it like, Jane, to be sending out your poems into the world? Like over, so in these last 10 years, because they've been placed in many places, as the acknowledgement page shows. What is it like to have them in the world, but then to have them see them here in ponds?
Well, okay, this is kind of, people ask that question a lot. And so I'm reading a book called Stolen Focus right now by Johann Hari, and it's about technology. But he has this little section where he goes and he spends time in an artist's studio, like several weeks, just watching this artist paint. And what he notices eventually is that when the artist finishes the painting, he just puts it against the wall and immediately starts another one. And that resonates with me so strongly, because I finish a poem and it's gone from me in a weird way. And then I start another one, because you never say what you want to say. T.S. Eliot talks about this in East Coker, like beautifully. He writes about, you only have the words for the thing that you no longer really need to say. So it's kind of I have to discipline myself to submit my poems out, because I tend to be less enamored of the ones that I've already written and more enamored of the ones I haven't written yet.
Well, because you're trying to find the energy again.
Yeah.
And the feeling and what you're thinking. Yeah. Well, Jane, would you read a poem for us?
Sure. Let's see. I will read this one here. It's called New Year's Morning. And I wrote this one while living in Phoenix. So it has a lot of Phoenix, Arizona flora in it. New Year's Morning. Rain again last night ripped the baby tips off the ends of the acacia, and now the sky's gray and tight-lipped over the hard bulk of the mesa. The new year's coming in cold today and silver. Today I am amazed by existence, by that weary old sun whose light is really time, glazed-eyed with travel. Today, unbound briefly, I stand beside that light and see it, incredulous, watch itself passing all around those bruised, oracular trees.
Thank you, Jane.
Yeah.
Thank you. And so, Jane, why did you pick that one to read?
I like that one because it has a really simple form. It just has the couplets and the pretty strict rhyme, but it's a little loosening. And I also really, I have kind of an obsession with time, which I think you would notice throughout the collection. I'm so interested in the relationship between time and eternity, and time and the natural world. Is time a natural phenomenon that's unfolding within, you know, the atoms and electrons and quarks and whatever makes up the smallest elements of material reality, or is time something else? How do angels interact with time? I don't know. I'm just so interested in time. And I've always liked that line, the weary old sun whose light is really time, glazed-eyed with travel. That, I think, is the closest I've gotten to saying what I want to say about time.
So cool.
That is so lovely.
And, yeah. And the rhythm of the rhyme also, like, somehow supports that inquiry or that seeking towards time. Like, I really like acacia and mesa. And I mean, there are some of those full rhymes, but I think the soft, like more half rhymes or softer rhymes add to that glow of the sun somehow.
And it's so interesting that you pick a poem and you mention about the form of it, because that is also, Jane, connecting to what Katie and James said earlier about the order and the structure and sort of the finding within that more paths.
Yeah.
Yeah, forward. So thank you for choosing that one.
Sure.
And yeah, that's okay. Well, let's take a short break and then we'll be back to hear more from J.C. Charle and her book Ponds, and Katie Hartsock, her book. We'll hear from Katie in the next quarter from the book Wolf Trees, or perhaps a new poem. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back.
I just want to.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today on the program, we have poet Katie Hartsock here in the studio, her latest book of poems, Wolf Trees, and we have poet J.C. Charle and her book of poems, Ponds, and Jane is joining us via phone. Thanks for your poem right before the break, Jane. So where everyone's going to be able to meet up tomorrow in a space on campus. It's the Measure of Mystery is the event tomorrow on Thursday, the 26th. And these three poets that we've been talking to today and getting to hear just like a glimpse into their poems will be there reading more from their poems. It's hosted by UM's Kateri Institute for Catholic Studies. And it's going to be at the Michigan League Ballroom at 6 p.m. second floor. It's open to the public, everyone. Everyone is invited. And there's a reception. There'll be books and a signing as well. So, yes, that's tomorrow. And I love the title, The Measure of Mystery. Because that feels like what we're talking about today.
I think so. Mystery is something that usually you think of as inchoate or without shape. And as James was beautifully saying earlier, the idea that maybe something that pulls us towards meter is the idea we can start to shape what seems sometimes like a unapproachable, chaotic,
unknowable
entities. Yeah. But I think that is something that pulls. And I think, you know, that can also happen in cadences of free verse, cadences of speech. Like I do think that there are moments of genuine musicality and rhythm in everyday language as well, just the way people talk to each other at those odd moments of the day. But I do think that there's something really special about that. I have to say, there's a kind of satisfaction about shaping and fitting that certain words into a rhythm and experimenting with rhyme, things like that.
Oh, and also having the ear where you hear the musicality, like you said, Katie, of everyday language. I feel like that directly connects to much of how you're working with some of the poems in Wolf Trees.
Yeah, I mean, I like to work in formal verse. I also work in free verse. And I think, you know, I want to just, you know, give a shout out. Like, James is such a wonderful formal poet, and Jane is also such an amazing formal poet. And the way that they each approach the forms, I always just admire so much, because, you know, Jane with her, like, slant rhymes and a kind of more a subtle spirit to some of the forms in her work. I just really admire. But yeah, I have different instincts. So like, sometimes a poem feels like, oh, I must shape this into a form and into meter and into rhyme. And then sometimes a poem just wants to stay, in like more of a free verse lineation and white space and things like that.
What do you feel like reading for us today from Wolf Trees?
I guess I will read... both James and Jane have mentioned, you know, important figures from the past. And so I think I will read a poem, and I will read some poems in meter tomorrow night, but this one isn't quite in a strict form. I have always loved studying Roman history, and I also grew up as a Catholic, but I don't think it was until I was in college, and I'd actually kind of been full of doubts at that time in my life, and was not attending church regularly or even thinking myself particularly as a Catholic. And at that time I was really delving into classical mythology and Roman history. And it struck me as so odd that Ovid, a poet I loved, would have been alive at the same time as the historical figure of Jesus Christ. And I don't know, something about that just blew my mind. I thought, it just seems like different worlds. But they were very much, you know, if not ever in the same town, that they were in the same, they were around the same places at the same time. And I was reminded of this when I learned that when John Wayne, the actor, was an intern for John Ford, and he actually met Wyatt Earp. And so I was like, that's impossible. Wyatt Earp and John Wayne never met.
Worlds collide.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, I think my poems like echoes across worlds where maybe echoes don't seem like the first thing you might think of. And so I'll just read this poem. John Wayne brings Wyatt Earp a cup of coffee. Before he became John Ford's leading man, the Duke worked for him in props and got to meet the Tombstone Marshal, the ancient and real cowboy, who had come to teach tanned actors all his ways of being real, how to walk while carrying a gun, how to fall down whenever hit with a bullet. I wouldn't have guessed they could have met, these different centuries of men and Wests, as when an older Ovid, on his way to exile, might have met a teenage Christ at some crossroads of the empire, and the epic, erotic, tragic, elegiac poet locked eyes with the youth in a way that made the sagebrush whir and thrum below the signposts to that big sky country, wild at the borders.
Thank you.
Oh my gosh, that gave me chills, Katie.
Oh, thanks, Jane.
I've even heard that before, but something about it hit me really hard this time.
Oh, how so? What do you think, Jane?
I think the first time I heard it, because I heard Katie read that at a reading maybe last year, and I was trying to follow the characters, but this time I knew how the characters would line up. And so the way that you made the switch from the more contemporary to the ancient, and then when the two locked eyes, it just really was, I don't know, I could see it. I could see Ovid and Christ locking eyes, and that was really effective.
Oh, thanks. I hope it happened one day. It would be great if it did happen.
I hope so, too. I hope for Ovid. Yeah.
Yes.
And you know it, because you've made the image for us. So now I think in a few years, I will have think it happened, regardless.
Yeah. Oh, you know that time.
Yeah. I think they high-fived. No, it was eyes locking. It was eyes locking. Yes.
Yes.
And I do love the sound, like the whir of the sage, but it all feels like these moments of where it's very like a real, you can feel it, the tangible moment, but then even like the sage brush, like it feels like there's this holiness drifting to be otherworldly or so.
Yeah, I mean, the outskirts of the Roman Empire were really kind of a Wild West place. And so I wanted to, you know, cross those landscapes a little bit too. So
and all three of you as poets are crossing times and landscapes and bringing us to like the present moment. Like you can feel for each of you calling upon these images and moments into your poems, even though you are hearkening back to these other times as well, and connecting to the history of ideas in the faith in some way. But how does it feel for you all to be I guess you can't ignore the present moment. Like, why would you not have that in?
Yeah, I think that to be grounded in the present and the past feels to me like a constant activity. You know, I've just been teaching the Iliad, and I feel like when I'm teaching the Iliad, everything around me takes on this like more electric light, like every like mortality and connections between people. Like I feel like the Iliad like lights up my life somehow when I'm teaching it. And I feel like that's something special about so many different things from the past or things from, I think certain prayers can also do that for me. Like I think after we say the Saint Michael, Archangel, defend us in battle prayer at the end of Mass, I feel like that also affects the way I feel when I walk out into the world. So that there's something about the incantatory prayer for protection. I don't know. I feel it. Do you, I don't know, Jane, do you feel that prayer and poems in the past can like kind of light up your present moment in the same way?
Yeah, definitely. I think that I tend to struggle more to ground my poetry in the present. I have this eternal impulse to ground all my poetry in the past. So I'm always trying to figure out how to pull it, whether that's through using newer forms or using slangy language or different themes or something like that, how to pull things into the present. Because the past does seem so illuminated. And I think some of that's because we can look back at it and we can see the threads that are important. They've made themselves clear. And then I look at the present and it just looks like a muddle and I don't know what thread to follow.
But you are grounding it in like the natural world, definitely, like collecting pebbles by the Puget Sound, the ponds that you mention, like how it was so vivid to be able to hear about you living by a pond and in a trailer with the family, and then to be suddenly in Phoenix, like to be in a totally different place where you wouldn't expect that, but a different landscape that you're connecting to, and your family are within, are called upon, and your mother she's throughout many of these
poems as well, as a trout, I would say. That trout with your father stands out. I don't know. I don't know why I'm trying to argue with you, Jane. No, I'm just meeting you over the phone on a radio show.
Well, it's been my big effort, and I'm trying to, on my next project, I'm trying really hard to make it, I mean, as, like, contemporary as I can. I'm just trying to push into a new kind of voice. So it's nice to know that you are hearing some of that.
Oh, yeah. And I would also add that your poem, Church Cleaning, I just love that so much. And that is so much, like, the world's grounded in that present moment.
Oh, good. I'm really glad.
Jane, thanks for being here via phone today. Today on Living Writers, J.C. Charle joins us via phone. Katie, thanks for the hour of you being here in
person.
Thank
you so much, T. And again, shout out to Scott Lyons and the Kattery Institute. Come by Michigan League tomorrow night, 6 p.m. I hope to see you there.
And you've just been hearing from poet Katie Hartsock. In the first half hour, we had poet James Matthew Wilson. Tomorrow. Yeah. The Measure of Mystery, 6 p.m. at the Michigan League Ballroom. Thanks, everyone out there, for listening. Until next time.
Your radio is on. It's on 88.3 FM, WCBN-FM, Ann Arbor's 24-hour open-minded radio surprise pudding, licensed to the Regents of the University of Michigan, operated by students at the University of Michigan, uniquely maintained as a healthy alternative and a positive influence on the mental health of the Ann Arbor community. You are here.
Good evening and welcome back to the WCBN Daily Sports Report. My name is Noelle Bensi and I'm joined here alongside with a great group of panelists and dear friends, Jake Singer, Reagan Dufresne, Jake Handler, and Eddie Olenicek. How are we doing today, guys?
Doing well, Noelle. How about yourself?
Doing wonderful. It's been quite a crazy day, but you know.
Yeah, I feel that. Happy to be back in the studio.
Yeah, I mean, what's the better way to end the day than being on the DSR? That's all I'm going to say.
It's been a while.
So today, we'll be going into a little bit something different. Obviously, we'll transition later into the big USC win this last weekend. But we'll be starting with my favorite topic in sports, and hopefully it is also your favorite topic in sports, women's sports. So, coined, hopefully, throughout the rest of the season, Women's Sports Wednesdays.
Absolutely.
I know you guys are ecstatic to talk about it because I know I am, okay? We have three sports going on already. We have volleyball, soccer coming to an end, and our ranked field hockey team. Like I mentioned before, we'll go over the win at USC and what we expect to see from Michigan's football team against Minnesota this Saturday on Parents Weekend. Getting into it. The volleyball team recently opened opens Big Ten Conference play at home, hosting Michigan State at Rutgers. They started the season on a 9-game win streak before falling to North Carolina in a tight 5-set match, but rebounded with a sweep over Duke. Against the Tar Heels, Michigan took the first and fourth set, but fell